Hello, everyone, and welcome to the GMS Magazine podcast, Vidcast, wherever you are that you're watching this, either in YouTube or in just listening to the podcast, which will be a very sensible thing to do. This is the today's a role-playing game interview room. I am with my co-host, Chris Diaz.
Hello.
And
I'm Chris.
Yes, you are. And we have an absolutely amazing guest that I have a very good question to ask. Hannibal Taboo. And Hannibal, you have right now a campaign going on.
Yes, sir.
To crowdfund The Sundering. So The first question I have is, can you please tell me what the hell did I just back?
Oh, I'm happy to tell you. Okay. So, once upon a time, there was a world, and this world called Imperial, I have to remember, I always mix those two things up, had a place called the Zwari Nation. And this was a very diverse fantasy land of dragonborn and giants and humans and elves and dwarves and what have you, all living in relative peace and general safety. I mean, they had their share of demonic incursions or, you know, the challenges from the astral plane, but what part of the material plane doesn't? In general, they were fine. And until one day, about 6 months before the setting of the game begins, when on an average Thursday, people were minding their business and looked to the western skies and saw something horrible, a 600-foot figure, gray ashen angel falling from the sky on fire into the ocean. This was Orin, the ashen angel, the second most powerful god in the heavens. And then after that, two blades of fire, thousands of feet high, chopped down on the northern border. Because this place is, imagine like Magic California. It's a California-sized nation on the western coast of a continent.
I thought California was magic.
Depends on the day. But all of a sudden, this place goes from being a nation on the side of a continent to an island in the middle of an ocean on a completely different planet. In a completely different dimension. And they've got to figure out what that means or not as they proceed with their lives. And that is the idea behind The Sundering, The Nation Beneath Our Feet, the Dungeons & Dragons 5th Edition, I'm sorry, I'm not allowed to say it, the D&D 5e campaign setting book that is on Kickstarter that we're very, very happy to say is doing, I think, pretty well. And we're very, very grateful for all the people helping.
Awesome. When I was reading the setting outline, because you said for just when I was reading the information, what I could glean from the page, I thought for a while that when this god comes down and basically asunders, excises this country, this part of this continent from this world, that it was adrift like the moon in space 1999, that it was adrift in space. And it lands on some other random world, like the ship from Craw, as I show my unfortunate age, and lands in some kind of new place. So
that's your story, not wrong. It's just slower than it happens because it happens like that. And so it's just Orin doesn't do he didn't see it coming. He didn't know what happened. He was just taking along for the ride with everybody else.
Right. So my interpretation, and when I was reading it, I thought this is what I pulled from it. I was like, this is a way of quite literally dropping progressive ideas into what's commonly judged to be a very, lack of a better word, traditional vanilla fantasy. Vanilla in every case of the word is kind of literally like, I'm going to take my world and literally drop it into your traditional fantasy world, quite literally in every aspect.
100% accurate assessment of what I did.
Now, while you were describing that, I mean, Orin and the Orishas, is this based on the Yoruba tradition?
Well, the fun fact about this has gods from a number of traditions. It has Egyptian gods, it has Kemetic, Yoruba gods, it has Mayan gods, because many of these gods from their own pantheons and from their own worlds got bored. They're like, I'm going to go be a god somewhere else. And now eclectic collection of gods has collected here in the Zwari Nation. And the interesting part is that the Sundering took these gods from the world that they were on and put them on this new world, and they don't know how to get back.
Okay. I like the sound of that an awful lot, and it's interesting that you're mentioning, we're talking today, because the very concept of all the gods living in one place, you know, all happy, you know, all the pantheons living together without any kind of issues, and then arriving this, including the satanic and all the hells and everyone, you know, not just, you know, the gods, but everyone living together in a kind of happily, not particularly ever after, because it ended.
Mostly fine.
You know, it was something that I was listening about today in a podcast called Mythology that was kind of recreating the Paradise Lost poem. And it speaks about how this happens until Christian tradition comes and then everything gets messed up. You know,
okay.
Which we have a tendency of doing, you know, I hate to say it, but as a former Catholic, I kind of know that part. Yeah.
So I'll let you two part talk about that. I don't need to add any comments to what you said there.
I will compound on Paco's point, though, the fact that as someone that whenever I'm an RPG publisher as well, my books are out of sight because this is not about me. But I often pull inspiration from mythology, and unfortunately, the big mythologies have been tapped to such an extent that there's nothing much original. So what was that part of the, like, I can imagine there were probably several motivations to pull from lesser known mythologies, lesser known in the West, most certainly. Why did you pick Orisha and Kemetic myths, and are there other mythologies from in that region? Because obviously you're just picking from one specific region. Just from my research, I know there's a couple dozen other mythologies on that continent. Do you plan on pulling these other ones, and why did you pick these ones specifically?
Well, the first thing that they teach writers is to write what you know. I've been practicing Kemetic spirituality since 92. My son practices Ifa, which is the Yoruba religion. I actually, for the Oath of Invocation Paladin subclass that I was talking about, I spent about a half hour, 45 minutes on the phone with an Ifa priest, making sure I got the details right, making sure that I was as close as I could be to that. And for me, big mythologies of the West mean nothing to a billion Chinese people, mean nothing to a billion people in India, mean nothing to, you know, a large swath of the world. The Western world, while it's often centered by itself and often important to itself, is not always the most important thing to other people. And while I did grow up in the Western world, let's just say I don't have the greatest affection for many of its traditions therein, and I went looking otherwise for both my own spiritual path and my own life. The people in my life don't really center those traditional myths, and the work that I do clearly could not.
How long have you been playing role-playing games? I mean, we've spoken a little bit about your game, but we know nothing about you. I mean, what qualifies you to write this book? I'm sorry to be that brutal. I mean, I'm not questioning that you're there, but, you know, why do you want to do?
What gives you the right, sir?
Well, as I used to do record reviews for like Vibe magazine and MTV and whatever, and people would also often ask me, what gives you the right to do this? I'm like, because they paid me to. But in this case, I started playing Dungeons and Dragons, you know, as in junior high or whatever. I had to move away from my group, but then I rediscovered what we call MUDs, multi-user dimensions, in college, which are telnet-based, text-based Dungeons and Dragons games, which I love because I was like, I don't have to carry anything. I just log in and I go. You do all the math. I don't have to do any of that. Let's go. Yeah. So I played
MUDs. I feel so old. I remember all of that.
Telnet? Logging into Telnet? We're kicking it old school here.
Calling up the Freenet on your dial-up 2400 baud modem.
Exactly. So bringing that, a lot of that MUD experience, really, because that's really where I wanted to recreate the idea that, you know, there was this sprawling open world, kind of like a Grand Theft Auto, but for fantasy. And whatever direction you go, there's something there. many of those things may kill you, but you may actually be able to survive. And that sort of adventure setting was very attractive to me. So that's really what I tried to bring forth. When I played on a MUD, and that MUD was called Imperial Gizmo, which is how I got the names for both the world and the continent here.
That's how it's pronounced.
That's not how it's pronounced in the game, but that's how it's pronounced when I was playing. But yeah.
Okay.
My character was able to ascend to godhood, as on MUDs you're able to do. And I was like, ooh, great, I'm going to make an area about the Babylonian afterlife. And ooh, great, I'm going to make this. And they were like, we've got a backlog. Your areas can't get through. I'm like, but your areas are not reflecting my spiritual understandings or the spiritual understandings of literally millions of people around. And they were like, yeah, whatever, we'll get to you. So I was like, all right. So I just had all these areas written up and planned out, and they were just sitting there. And then my good friend Damien Poitier, who was on Geek and Sundry on a show called Ask Your Black Geek Friend. He's very close with B. Dave Walters, who people know from G4 and from other places. And he says, why isn't there a more ethnic Dungeons and Dragons setting? I'm like, I could do that. He was like, what do you mean? And we started working together and getting this idea. And it all rolls out into this book that ends up as The Sundering, The Nation Beneath Our Feet. And I hope that it not only reflects a different, as Damon said, putting some color into your campaigns, but also gives people an experience they'll be able to enjoy and appreciate the depth of which I did things. So like, I figured a lot of things out while I was working through this. I was like, all right, how do the streets get clean? There's low-level mages who the only spell they know is prestidigitation. And they make, you know, whereas the normal person makes 6 gold a year, they make 18 gold a year by just walking around and prestidigitating the streets. That's their job. And, you know, they're never motivated to become adventurers because adventurers almost die all the time. So a lot of those details I worked into the world to make sure that it was a fully functioning society that, you know, made sense, had its own politics. And when people walk through it, they could have consequences. They could change them.
Wow. So speaking about what you were just saying there, there was a bit of a tension about, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago. Puck and I talked about it in a previous one about, I can't remember who it was, but they were complimenting what they felt was the first time they ever saw a non-white character in a D&D game. And there was a lot of comments, the fact that people were raising their hand going, actually, no, that's this book here was first. And then another person raised their hand and said, no, this one from 2010 was first. And then I raised my hand and said, no, I got characters in my 2008 Amethyst book, just FYI. And then
Amethyst.
Just saying that.
No. Do not make me break out my Dark Opal lore on you. Please do not make me.
Are you both going to geek out on each other? Because that would be amazing. I mean, that would be incredible.
So how important was representation in the creation of this setting?
For me, I remember when I took my daughter to see Black Panther, and the way that she saw the Dora Milaje, the way that she saw Nakia, the way that she saw the rulers from like the merchant tribes and so on and so forth. And I remembered a cartoon that was actually drawn after, you know, a real life situation where it said 1970 something, and it showed a little white boy looking at the television at the president. It's like, I can do that. And then it showed Obama in like 2008 with a little black boy pointing at the TV, like, I can do that. And I was like, the idea of normalizing your experience is of utmost importance to me. So, you know, the idea that, I want people to get used to the idea of casting Lakeisha's Magnificent Mansion, or I want to get people used to the idea of, you know, I'm trying to think of one of the, for example, like a dragon wormling named Jamar, which is one of the characters in one of the encounters, and is based on this kid that I went to school with, Jamar Nicholas, I went to school with in Memphis. So I want to normalize our names, our pronunciations, you know. I always say it's like, if you can pronounce Yggdrasil, you can clearly pronounce Dontranil, you know, and you can clearly
pronounce. I have problems pronouncing the first one. The second one was easier. Yggdrasil.
Exactly. So when I see, you know, I want there to be a Sriram in my book. I want there to be, you know, a Lourdes in my book. I want to see reflections of the world that I see. Because when I go to work, when I go to, you know, out into my neighborhood, these are the people that I see. And I want them to be reflected in this myth. So when you normalize something as myth, it becomes something in the cultural enrichment of who you are and in the interpretation of how you see the world. So if we see, oh, Thor is a good idea, a drunken, berserking Norseman with a hammer who wants to resort to violence all the time, then why can't we likewise say, okay, Shango is a good idea, a god of fire with a hammer who, you know, maybe resort to violence if he feels like it, but really doesn't go lean to that first, or a trickster god like Anansi and so on and so forth. Making these things normalized across things gives a more level playing field, and I'm a big advocate of that.
Which is indeed very fair enough, and I think, personally, I think it's long, long, long overdue. Now, I have a question. When you were talking with, you know, you mentioned how you talked with this priest about to make sure that you have the character correct and you have all the details, did you actually tell them what you wanted the information for, and what was their reaction? You didn't. How would you think?
Oh, wait, no, I told them what I wanted the information for.
Right.
Yes, I said, I said basically, the thing that I just said here, I said basically that to him. And he was like, wow. Because he had played Dungeons & Dragons in junior high, just like I had. And he was like, I don't remember anything that was anything like anything I do. I'm like, and that's something I'd like to fix. So when we're working on what's called the Oath of Invocation palette subclass, where invocation is throughout many African spiritual traditions, something is done where you don't pray to something like a saint or an intercessor. You pray to become, you pray to transform yourself, or as the Kemetics say, kepara, into a manifestation of that. So there are elements of this nature god that this subclass can kind of change into. As a shorthand, I call them the polymorph paladins, because they change, at different levels, they can change into different things with different abilities. But yeah, that's, I wanted to bring something like that because in invocation magic, it's not represented in the traditional eight schools of magic of Dungeons & Dragons. And I really, at first I was kind of disheartened, like, well, I guess I have to just play with these eight schools of magic. And I was watching Critical Role, of course. And I'm like, this clown made a whole school of magic called Dunamancy? Oh, y'all have messed up now. So I felt empowered. So thank you to Matt Mercer for that. I felt empowered to create the magical traditions which I was familiar with.
Wow. On a side, I cannot get through the trailer for Wakanda Forever now without crying. I'm not sure. Isn't that a gut punch?
Cut me deep, man. Me deep.
Oh, it's such a brutal thing. Anyway,
when she said, "Have I not given everything?" Oh, come on now.
Yeah, she doesn't get a nomination for something, that'll be. But anyway, so on that topic, though, about magical school, you're absolutely right. Am I feeling everything in D&D is in pencil? So you should be able to erase and modify basically what you were thinking, just like that. I created a magic magical school based around nihilists, and another one based off of entropy.
I like it.
Transfer of energy. So, like I said, it's all up in the air. But I wanted to get into like the hard question. So given the recent progressive shifts in the industry, how does your setting the sundering approach the evolving definition of race, both in how we define it in our world and how D&D has often mislabeled it in their publications?
I'll give a good example. Okay. In my game, there are two drow cities as a part of what's called the Dusk Supremacy. That is the nation of the drow, right? One drow city in the south is called Busara, and they're isolationist. They're very, what you would almost call traditional drow, matriarchal, following a god that's very angry and xenophobic. And then there's the other drow city in the north, Iyubi. And the other drow city in the north has allowed a franchise to come in of a soul food restaurant called Batter and Salt from the nearby magical city up above. And they've started negotiations with the nation to possibly leave the Dusk Supremacy. And maybe I shouldn't have said it, but it's too late now. Anyway, but they're a much more open society. They're known to the surface. They have regular relationships with the surface. And they follow a different drow god that is of dance and of magic and of happiness and of joy and of music. So these two drow societies are in an uneasy tension with each other, in the same way that in the role-playing world, that there is an uneasy tension between people who say, oh, drow are just like this, and they're just mean, and they're just, you know, whatever. And people say, drow can be anything. Drow can do anything. And that dichotomy is literally played out in the game in the struggle between these two cities and these two, essentially, cultures.
Yeah, because, of, I mean, because the sin that I kind of bring up with traditional D&D was the commingling of the idea of race and culture. The idea that there's idea what defines the, humanity, because because obviously we're, despite the differences physically that we may have, we are 0.1% variation of genetic information. When you get down to science, we're all basically clones, and so we don't have another completely alien species on Earth to compare ourselves with. We can only know what humanity is like. We're we are community bound. We are by default omnivores. Our brains are basically glorified pattern recognition machines, and we don't really know what a fey race would be in definition. Mm-hmm. But our culture is completely varied, and there's always been this issue: the fact that drow are this, drow have this, and the dwarves are always going to be this attitude, and they're going to think like this, and they're going to have these things. And that's always been something that that I started to become more responsible for in my own writing, is not conflating the idea of culture to race. In my setting, the drow are albinos, so I flip it. And there's a culture which is diametrically opposed to their actual mannerisms. And so the entire species is basically suffering from cognitive dissonance, because they're being told from their hierarchy to act in a way that's against their actual nature. So the idea of, once again, is do you introduce any new races, or are you playing off of the species and the cultures that are represented in classic D&D?
I do. There's one new race which is called the Vengi. It's a very, and I'm really not supposed to say very much about them, because they're stretch goal, and the co-creator Damien Poitier is very, very, very passionate about them. I will say this. That they are an underground, they live in a place deep, deep underground called the Forest of Bones. And they have, I'm trying not to say too much. They have a reason why they are very separate from all other races, and that they do not ally or they don't lower themselves to the struggles that many other things have. They have a perspective that is different. It's, I'm trying not to say too much, because Damon's going to scream at me.
That's fine.
Yeah, so yeah, there's one new race called the Vengi, and there's a number of subclasses. And we are using these new elements to add interesting things between the things that are already there. So for example, whereas there's a large community of warforged in the south, and there's a large community of storm giants in the north, and there's a large community of dwarves in the southeast, and so on and so forth, that doesn't mean that's the only place where they are. That doesn't mean that's the only place where they live. That doesn't mean the only place that they do. That all the dwarves aren't miners. All the giants aren't berserkers. All the warforged aren't, you know, whatever people think warforged do. So, yeah, there's a lot of means by which I give flexibility, and I avoid what writer James Roberts called functionism, that I say, you are this, therefore you must do this. I'm not a fan of that. I'm not a fan of that in my life. I'm not a fan of that in my writing. So I work very hard to support. One of my favorite characters, and this is one that the artist came up with, that we came up as an NPC, is this bard. He's an orc bard named Zorik Cole. And, you know, his family were all mostly fighters, but he wanted to sing. He wanted to sing. And, you know, he liked fancy clothes, he liked fine dining, and he liked all these things that were very, very unlike what most of his family were. And they were like, you're weird, but we love you anyway. What do we need to do to support your dreams? So, yeah, there's a lot of places like that where I subvert the tropes and do things in different ways that I think are, very entertaining.
Oh, man, my own heart there. So are the there are most of the peoples within your setting are recognizable to traditional 5e players?
Yes, yes. You would be able to walk through a regular town and say, oh, that's a Celestial. Oh, that's a Lizard Folk. Oh, that's a Yuan-Ti, you know. Yeah, I mean, I didn't want to spend a lot of time making races because what I wanted to do was get to the story. 5e fans, they're used to a lot of things. And I didn't want to change Eldritch Blast into something completely different. It's Eldritch Blast. Let's go on to Eldritch Blast. I didn't need to change the frameworks of the rules there, as in what sort of person you can be, what sort of things you can do. What I wanted to do was, I'm like, but what world would you live in if things were different than what you've seen? If you were able to see, a place where literally every race can mingle in a very fairly safe place because of certain rules that I play. My favorite thing, I was worried about PvP, which on the mud that I played was dealt with by the fact that if you tried to attack another character, it just wouldn't let you because that's the way it was coded. Mm-hmm. So here I was like, I can do that. If Orin, the god of order, this Ashen Angel, all adventurers have to get a license, and that license marks them for Orin. So if they try to attack another adventurer, Orin sees it and he doesn't react kindly. So I tried to build those sorts of things into the world and make it a place where people could understand how safety could work, how tolerance and consent across cultures, across races could work, theoretically, if you have a magical engine and a horrible god willing to strike down anybody who does things that you don't like.
Then, of course, it creates a follow-up question, which immediately pops in my head. It's like, how does the Orin, the god, define what is somebody you can attack and what is somebody you can't? Like, if we're trying to prevent PvP, which is also PV NPC who's civilized, so you can't just go out and beat the crap out of a bartender, despite no matter how bad the drink was. How does Orin define a monster you can kill compared to a monster you have to talk to, per se?
Many people in the nation have questioned this, and there are controversies over what is and what is not allowed in this regard. This is actually a point of great debate that happens here. The idea is that if you have a bunch of essentially weapons of mass destruction walking around, which is what adventures are, they're weapons of enormous amounts of violence in a world where most people have 2 hit points and make 6 gold a year, they have to have certain licenses for their behavior. So they're licensed to use violence in an extra legal fashion in certain circumstances. Like, say, for instance, you know, Batman and the Bat Signal. The Gotham City Police is licensed, essentially, Batman to go beat up poor people in alleys while wearing fetish gear. That's his gig. That's what the state has agreed to. Sure. In this case, the adventurers are not supposed to turn on each other because that would create complete bloodshed if they start fireballing at each other in the middle of the town square. There are, however, legal protections therein. So if they do fireball in the town square and decide to attack a bunch of civilians, these protectors of that city, that's what the cops are called, they're all called protectors, will show up immediately in force and in overwhelming power. They will just come down like 20 dudes who essentially would be 20th level fighters are going to show up and start coming at you with 4 attacks per round, action surge, second wind, crap. So the threat of that kind of violence keeps the adventurer community mostly under control in civilized areas.
Except when you just want 4th edition mechanics, not 5th edition mechanics. Action surge, second wind. I'm like, oh, I remember how much I loved 4th edition. Sorry,
go on. those are still in 5th edition. Yeah,
Second wind? I don't think second wind.
Second wind is in 5th edition, yeah. Right. It's a fighter ability.
Okay.
Yeah. And like I said, they're all essentially 20th level fighters. So.
It's like any MMO.
All right, you know. So I created that. There is, as I said, a variance. Once you get out into the wilderness, once you get out into the wilds, then only Orin is watching to make sure you don't kill other adventurers. But if you kill, you know, random people wandering around, that's something you can do if that's what your alignment supports. If you're chaotic evil, if you're, you know, lawful evil, and you believe I can kill these people, they're just civilians and they're in my way and I want something, so who's to stop me? In the wilds, that question is no one. And that seems to be an unfair abuse of Oren's bond that many people philosophically argue about. And that's something, if people choose to play in their game, they totally can, because it's the hook, the story hook is right there.
I'm curious about what kind of stories can be told with the game. And let me explain exactly where I'm coming from, because one of the things I read an awful lot of settings, because I love stories and lore and background more than rules. I have rules I don't give a toss about. And one of the things that to me makes a setting successful is when I'm reading it and I'm thinking, oh, I could play that, and I could play that, and I could play that, and this adventure and that adventure. Whereas there are other settings that I just close the book and think, I don't know what to do with this. Mm. I have no idea where to take it, how to take it, how to scale it. I'm lost. What have you done? What have you done to make sure that that doesn't happen? And guides the kind of stories that can be told with the Sundering.
I've done two things. First, we have what are called encounter packs. So the book as a base came with three basic adventures that you start on, three modules basically that you can run as adventures. They are based on, one is like level 4 to 7, one is level, I think, 12, 10 to 13 or so, and then there's a high level one. How you respond to each one of these, the story hooks, will put you on what's called a path. There's the path of heroes, if you want to be a good person. There's the path of scoundrels, if you want to kind of maybe not be a good person. There's the path of wonder, if you want to just see kind of what weird, wild, wacky stuff is out there in a kind of like Lost in Space, Fantastic Four, science, adventure, discover sort of way. There's the path of wonder, path of scoundrels, path of heroes. There's a path of faith where you choose essentially a faith, a god, and you follow them on a mission that's specific to your faith. So let's say, for example, you're following, I don't know, Oya. You might be, Oya may have a conflict with Irin, the goddess of betrayal. And Oya sends you on missions to stop Irin's efforts through Irin's champions, Irin's tools, Irin's whatever. Wonder, faith, scoundrels, heroes, rogues. Yeah, those are the five paths that I currently have. And we've already unlocked the path of scoundrels and the path of heroes expansion packs. So those will be three, each one will have three new adventures along that line that you can follow. That's the first thing that I did. I made the path. The second thing I did was, like I said, I wanted to make an open world. So I wanted to create a space for anything to happen. So for example, one of the groups, I'm playtesting this with two groups, and a group had to go, a group had this NPC that was really squishy that they wanted to keep with them, and it died. And they were like, we have to get this person alive, but they didn't have a cleric. So there's a place called the Unholy Cabaret, which is basically a vampire theater of horrors. It has ghosts, it's terrible. And it's really made for high levels, but if you're fast and if you're sneaky and if you roll well, you can sneak through there and accomplish one thing, because sitting in one place, there's a ring called Eternity's Kiss. And once a day, this ring can bring one person back to life if they haven't been dead for 24 hours. The problem is, if you take the ring, then the vampires will hunt you forever, wherever you go, no matter what happens. So the group, they got the ring, they revived the NPC, and then they had this big argument about whether or not they were going to take it. Reason finally prevailed. They left the ring, and they left, and no one was any the wiser because their stealth rolls were high enough and what have you. I wanted to make that possible for a low-level group to be able to go to a high-level area and theoretically survive if they make the right choices. If they had instead said, I'm going to go this way and go upstairs, they were all going to die. They were all going to die fast. But I tried in the encounter to deter them from that and to urge stealth and moving quickly. And they followed the hook well enough, and there was not a TPK. So, yay.
Chris, we cannot hear you. You're muted.
Sorry, I was trying to avoid I was coughing. Does everything follow 5th edition architecture? Like, do you alter anything? Do you go into the 5e mechanics and twist them a little bit? Like, does magic work exactly the same way in your setting as it does in traditional 5e? Have you bent anything?
I have not really bent anything because as our friend said, I'm much more interested in the story than the rules. And I want it to be modular. So for example, one of my, I had a player come in, is like, I have a character on Eberron, but I don't want to change him. I was like, don't change him. It's simple. When the Sundering hit, there was a dimensional shake throughout dimensions and your guy fell on our world. And that's another reason why I tell people, I never say what world this landed on. Did it land on Exandria? Did it land on Eberron? Did it land on, I don't know. Is it outside of Barovia with Curse of Strahd? I don't know. You tell me, because I don't really care. If you want to bring your own characters, if you want to bring your own experience, if you want to bring this into whatever world you're already playing, go nuts.
Modern day Earth. It lands right in the middle of the Pacific Ocean.
I can't wait for somebody to try to roll Fireball in San Diego Comic-Con. Let's, let's deck save that in your cosplay, pal. Come on.
the answer to the question I wanted to ask, you know, how compatible, in brackets, it was going to be with people who wanted to introduce this to, I don't know, I just said Forgotten Realms or Eberron or Dragonlance or Spelljammer, now that's coming out, and it would be really interesting.
All you need is an ocean. All you need is an ocean where they can have enough room to not be able to see land from the nation, and it can go anywhere.
There's another thing that's catching my attention, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm liking the sound of it quite a lot. And it's like I get the feeling that the gods here are a lot more involved with the lives or, you know, anyone than they're in D&D. You know, today I was musing, and I raised a TikTok video saying, you know, it's weird that gods in, you know, traditionally in D&D, gods only grant powers to clerics. So anyone
or paladins, yeah.
Well, yeah, but anyone who goes to, you know, goes to service every week and is devoted and prays and does the offerings and follow the tenets, they get nothing. I thought, that's bullshit. You know, what would happen, you know, if anybody and everybody could get the favor of the gods, even if it's just a smidgen, tiny little favor, you know, but you could just maybe purify water or create some food or heal a wound that you've done at work. Everyone who is devoted to gods. And I'm getting the feeling that this is more the kind of thing that you would be able to get in the Sundering, because it sounds like gods are a lot more involved in the everyday life, which would make a lot of sense. Am I on the right track?
1,000%. These are absolutely interventionist gods at every step. They are very interested in mortality, partially because they're bored and partially because the order of heaven has put certain rules upon them. Orin is, as I said, Orin is the second most powerful god. He's been the second most powerful god for three top gods. There was Atacarsu, the great uninterested goddess who ruled all things, and Orin helped Castor overthrow her. Then when Castor went mad with power and decided to do things that would wreck the mortal world, Orin helped Borzoi, the spirit of chaos, overthrow Castor. Now, some would say, can you really trust this guy? But, you know, he's done this in an interest of what he believes is the best for the world. He likewise has put rules on gods. Gods can't randomly, you know, strike down mortals for kicks. They can't do that sort of thing. But, say, for instance, Afriel, the spirit of compassion, if she sees a neighborhood or a village is suffering, she can just say, control water. I'm going to give you some rain so you can grow crops. I'm going to send my champion to be there for a month to fight off any monsters that may come. I'm going to, you know, these are directly interventionist gods that can't even manifest in different ways. Each adventuring clan has to have a god sponsor them. So each adventuring clan has a direct relationship with a god and receives a boon as a member of that clan for really ridiculous fees that helps them in their everyday life. For penitents, for regular, as you say, regular civilians, if you live out, say, in the village of Dronkile, and you become devoted to Afriel, and Afriel sees that you're, because Dronkile is a messed up little village out in the west, you would then find that when you go to do something, it's a little bit easier. It's a little bit easier for you to bring in some food. It's a little bit easier for you to make it up a certain hill, which suddenly for you doesn't feel like the incline is as high, and so on and so forth. They're very interventionist gods, which give the most obvious way for me as a DM, let's say you have a play, a group, and one of your players says, oh, I can't come today. Okay. The god of, let's say the god of new beginnings. Oya. Oya has summoned this character to do something that they need help with. And then you write a little side thing. This is what Oya had to do. Go back. And you make that refer to your actual story. And then you bring Oya brings them back the next week. And it's perfectly fine. I fixed scheduling. You're welcome.
That sounds pretty good.
So looking at the campaign now, moving out of the setting, talking about the campaign as we kind of wrap the things up here to mm-hmm. get a nice even hour, because Paco is going to turn into a pumpkin soon.
Ooh, can so, I see that? Is that polymorph? Okay.
So you're sharing credit with a gentleman named Damien Poitier. Mm-hmm. Who is Damien Poitier for those people who have yet to discover your campaign?
Damien Poitier is an actor, a stuntman, and a writer, and he was in the first Avengers movie. When you see Thanos turn, that was Damien Poitier. On the Incredible. Show The Flash, I know, right? Before they cast Brolin. For the show The Flash, he plays a character called Goldface. He has worked in Star Trek. He's worked in, like, he's in Captain America's Civil War, getting kicked in the face by Scarlett Johansson. He's, you know...
Man, if I had most a dime each time...
most of the genre stuff, you know, he's probably been in it. His IMDb is sick. And what he loves more than any of those things is playing Dungeons and Dragons. And he wanted to play. So, okay, I think, is Laura going to be mad at me? I'm not going to tell that whole thing. But he wanted to play with some people that he knows. And he got the idea, well, what if we filmed it? What if we streamed it? And he says, but I don't want to play just regular, you know, regular games. I want to play something that reflects myself. I'm like, I can do that for you. And we collaborated together on a lot of the ideas. He created a wizard subclass called the Battle Magi that he wanted to play. That's very, very interesting. But yeah, he came up with the idea for the Vingi, and we are collaborators in building this idea out. Likewise, he's already got a lot of hooks in the TTRPG world. As I said, you know, he and B. Dave Walters did a show called Ask Your Black Geek Friend on Geek and Sundry, and he's done the number one shots and stuff. But he's like, but what about me? Where can I be the star? I want to be the guy in front. I want to be the and in the Dungeons and the Dragons. And I'm like, I can do that for you. And now he is going to be Jace Kuduri, the battle mage, who is the central figure in this game, who he's an NPC that characters can run into. I mean, your game, technically, I guess you could kill him, but that's kind of messed up. Because he's no easy fight. But he's the central figure of this and essentially driving us forward into the public eye.
Awesome. So looking at the pledge goals, you have dice, you have a nice little box, you have the book itself. You also have this thing called a comics bundle.
Yes. Oh, wait, no, that's the thing I am allowed to talk about. I thought you were talking about the other thing. Yes. Lori Foster, the head of Unlikely Hero Studios, is a big believer in the concept that a rising tide raises all boats. So she's got deep connections in the indie comics community. And one of the pledge goals is one of the pledge rewards, rather, that she wanted to put forth was, hey, if you don't know all these Black comics creators, here's a whole bunch of their books that you may like and you may want to go check out some more. Many of them are people I've worked with personally. I believe they're actually putting in a book that I wrote called Project Wildfire is going in there. And it's an opportunity to, if there's a spotlight on me, then I can turn around and say, oh, you should find out about Cheryl Lynn Eaton. She's a genius. Oh, you should find out about Danny Fernandez. She's a genius. Or you should find out about Cheyenne, the geek. She's a genius. You know, I can, if somebody's shining a light on me, I can then reflect that light on people who are just as worthy who may not have that spotlight at that time. And hopefully, as I said, a rising tide raises all boats.
Yeah, I was recently, I'm trying to get a copy of A Door in the Distance, Mark Bernardin's new...
Beautiful work.
Yeah, I have his other ones, Genius and a few other ones, and I absolutely love what he does there. I like name dropping because Mark and I have actually had meet and have conversations almost every year because he comes up to my local fan con and I get a chance to pick his brain once in a while. So it was a lovely conversation talking with Mark. He's a fantastic individual and I absolutely love his writing. One of the things people can pledge is a campaign with you.
That is, I would be very pleasantly surprised if anybody did it, and I've got a very clear idea of what they would do. But yeah, that is one possibility, and it's a deep lore dive. It would if somebody did that, they would learn some stuff that's technically not supposed to be out until the second book. But you know, lawyers like go ahead if they're willing to give that much money, go for it.
Yeah, and we're at 4 stretch goals crossed at the time of this recording. Because certainly by the time it goes live, we will have crossed a couple more wins. So what's the next stretch goal? You don't say what it is. What's the next level? Like when currently at we're recording here, you're at just approaching 32. And what's your next stretch goal? What's the number?
What? How much money? Wait, what? I thought we were 24. Well,
oh, sorry. 32? My campaign automatically adjusts to Canadian pricing. That's the only thing.
Oh my God. you're at the moment at $24,172.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm sure someone can convert that to pesos.
Yeah. I thought you almost gave me a heart attack there. I believe, and let me look at what, because Lori has given me this cheat sheet. You talk about this, don't talk about this. I want to make sure I don't screw that up. Tom Holland. I don't want to be Tom Holland. It's not loading. Come on. Load. It's loading the pledge areas, but okay. I do know that we just put out a chibi t-shirt of this character called Irla Hagrin, the Mad Mage of Riverrun, which is a big story hook. We are looking at some more merchandise. I can safely say we're looking at some more merchandise levels to unlock in goals. We have so many more stories, encounter packs and subclasses that are possible to be unlocked. I think that's all I'm allowed to say. I'm trying to stay out of trouble. Let me see if I can scroll and see. Will it load? It's not loading. Let's play. Blah blah blah. Yada yada. Art's loading. Yeah, I think that's all I'm allowed to say, because if I say that, I know I'm not going to get in trouble.
So the campaign runs. I won't say how many days. It ends on Thursday, September 8th.
That's my understanding, yes, sir.
So, thankfully, your campaign and my campaign only cross for a week. So we're not going to be terribly in competition. Because my campaign,
I'll get out of your way and I'll point my finger your way.
Oh, thanks, man. This is how I can point your way. Thank you. Yeah, and of course, thanks to Paco, who said yes to all this. But yeah, so it's a fantastic campaign. Paco, on you?
On me, okay. Hard question. What are you going to do with my $100?
I am with your specific $100. Your specific $100.
Look,
should I say this? Okay. I'm gonna tell you something that I'm probably not supposed to say. With your specific $100, that will be used to produce the miniatures that will be added to many of the pledge levels. If that stretch goal is unlocked, and I was absolutely not supposed to say that, but I did it. And here we are.
I'm confident by the time this video goes up, you will have crossed that anyway. So I think you're good.
Yes, sir.
And I'm gonna be tweeting about this incessantly anyway. So yeah, it will get somewhere for sure. Now I do have a serious question though, because this is a very dear matter to me for reasons that will become obvious as soon as I ask them. How is the international shipping going to be handled? Because here in Europe, we are being spanked by the government every time that we get a parcel from the US. So please do something.
Well, I can say that the Kickstarter says ships to anywhere in the world. And I can also say, based on what I'm able to see here, because we have gotten pledges from lots of places that I did not expect, including the United Arab Emirates, Sweden, Spain, France, Greece, Germany, Australia, United Kingdom. So we're going to be doing some worldwide shipping. How that works is a publisher thing, and I'm going to admit my complete ignorance here. I'll tell you what, engage with me and Unlikely Heroes Studios on Twitter, and they will know the answer that I do not know, because, you know, in this case, they're the brains of the operation. I'm just pretty.
You are. That is one thing I have to corroborate, that unfortunately we are very often slaves to that. I was I was trying to find alternative distribution channels because unfortunately I am my company, so I have to be publisher. And my wife's an accountant, which is always a great idea if you want to be a publisher, marry a bookkeeper. So I was trying to, and I was doing some research, and it's just some of these rates I'm seeing from the U.S. to Europe is unfortunately very, 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 very distressing. Which is the reason why, like with my campaign and yours, obviously you're offering digital. Are you offering print on demand options as well for those people who back digital?
Okay. Based on my, this is really like, Lori is much smarter than me in all regards. I do know that she has, there's pledge levels that are physical books. And it is her commitment that no matter where this money comes from, no matter what happened, if somebody pledged enough to get a physical book, they're getting a freaking physical book. Now, how she's pulling that off, I would guess she's factored that into the budget. I'm a little ditzy in this regard because I've got literally 17 story threads of the Sundering by itself to remember all the time, not to mention the fact that I've got to then talk to my kid about, okay, so on the next season of Obi-Wan, it's probably going to be, I don't know.
The other question I had about this, though, is that it says estimated delivery December 2022. Really? That soon?
That's optimistic.
Okay, here's the gag. I'm done with the book, hands off of the book, on October 15th. Done. That is set in stone, come heck or high water, spirit willing and the creeks don't rise. The editing process has already begun. We're doing that in parallel. So we expect to be able to, have a file that can be made into a book by November. And that means if there's a
digital goes out, yeah.
Yeah, so digital can go out now. How long is it going to take actual physical books to get to people? Because I know that there's supply chain issues and we can't affect supply chain issues.
Yeah.
With one book that I had, the paper for it was sitting off the coast of San Pedro for 2 months and I couldn't do anything about that.
Don't get me started on that, man. I just finished my Kickstarter for Naramata. And yeah, it took 5 months to cross the ocean. So
yeah. As soon as we can physically make and create and ship the books, we will. There's no, let's sit around and smoke cigars with all this Kickstarter money. We're not going to be doing that. Unlikely Heroes has done 20 successful Kickstarters and they have fulfilled very regularly. They have a track record that is proven and I don't believe that they're interested in screwing it up at this point. We all have challenges that we're facing with this pandemic and with the choices people are making to extend this pandemic. So we're going to do the best we can to fulfill our promises as best as reality can. I mean, we don't have a wish spell, so we got to do what we got to do.
Exactly.
That's fair enough. I just hope you get a distributor in Europe so I don't get really messed up because my $100, that could easily end up costing me $170. No kidding.
Yikes.
Yeah, no kidding.
No, shipping prices to Europe. I was seeing some rates. Like my three games, the Amethyst one, which is 1,200 pages, is $130 to ship with the current distributor. So I'm trying to find somebody cheaper. I think I actually have found somebody cheaper. So I'm trying to, but once again, your book is 100, potentially 200 with stretch goals. I think people are aware that it will nearly double in size as we cross these stretch goals. Which means, thankfully, you don't have as much weight. The only issue would be, of course, the box and dice if people get them, and potentially something other rewards that we won't talk about. Wink, wink, wink. But 1,200 pages of book is like 15 pounds, and that costs a lot of money to transport. But unfortunately, as you said, we're slaves to factors out of our control.
Okay, I'm well.
So.
Sorry.
Yes, sir.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I know that one of the publishers I work with, Wonderman Comics, Nate Wonderman, he's flying over to, I think it's Belgium or Portugal. So I was like, maybe I could ask him to carry your book with him, but I'm not sure when he's leaving.
I tell you what, Belgium is a bit not close enough for a, stroll. But Portugal, I could probably jump in a plane and go and return on the day and, treat this man to lunch and...
He's a fun guy. He's a great lunch date. He's a great lunch date.
Well, if he's going to, Lisbon, I can get him there in about an hour.
I will keep that in mind.
I'm in the center of BC. It takes me 6 hours to go anywhere.
I'll be in DC tomorrow. My son is going to Howard. BC, he's starting BC. Next week at Howard. Oh, British Columbia. Sorry.
British Columbia. Yeah. No, in America, most places I've been to, it's like 15 minutes to another town and 15 minutes to another town. And I'm in Prince George, in the center of British Columbia, where the nearest town of equal of my size is 6.5 hour drive.
Wow. Okay.
That's lovely. That's very long. Okay.
Then, you're going to ask me a question?
Yes. One last question I have is the campaign is, of course, successful. It's going to happen. People are going to have their books. What happens to this world next? Do you have ideas? Yes, I bet you do. But do you have plans to actually expand and, develop the line?
Well, you mentioned a book, too. You mentioned a book, too, already.
Here's the thing. So I'm writing this book, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm a gigantic continuity nerd. Okay. I live for canon and continuity, right? So I'm writing it, and I'm like, well, if I write this in the book, then that's going to screw up. They're not going to follow this adventure, because clearly once they learn this, that'll change everything for their lives. And my brain was like, what I probably need is a Dungeon Master's Guide. So my goal, and I've been talking to, because the publishers are like, all right, what are we doing next? So my thought would be a Dungeon Master's Guide, which would, as the kids say, spill all of the tea and give them a much better idea of what the machinations behind the events that they see. Very early, the first adventure is where they go up against this group called the Insecurity, a group of what they think is just a small band of bandits. And it turns into much more than that. In the Dungeon Master's Guide, you'd find out why. You'd find out who started it, why it was started, and what its goal was, and what a challenge the Sundering itself became, because they had nothing to do with that. And I'm really saying more than I should, but yeah.
So spoilers. Spoilers.
The Dungeon Master's Guide would be my next goal, so I could get all this stuff out of my head and written down.
And then I imagine, of course, this will then continue on past this. The setting could grow and expand as its success grows and expands.
Can we have a beast? Very much so. Can we have a bestiary, please?
Absolutely. Well, yeah, the main campaign setting, it sets up general things. So you'll see combo cats, and you'll see beastly otifs, and you'll see certainly, things that are very specific to this world. But I didn't have time to go into detail, because each region, the Karma region, Ungel, Pana, Nalsentrut, there's a whole rich culture in each one of them. I could have done a book on any of them by themselves. So if this is successful, and people do like what I'm doing, and people do want, I could crank out 1, 2, 3, 4. I'm just thinking of the regions themselves. Karma, Proven Grounds, Pana, Nalsentrut, Smiling Coast. Nobody knows what's going on with the Zykas, so that's not that big. I could do a lot about that, but I'm not going to, because that's a funny joke for myself. So I could easily crank out, off the top of my head, 6 more books on it before I get to the Dungeon Master's Guide. And that's just based on the stuff that I didn't have room to fit into this book.
Okay, well,
because I was like, I've got this outline on my I use Scrivener, which is this app that I love. Yeah. I've got this outline like, okay, I can't include that. Like, but there's so many notes about it that I'm like, I'm ready to just write out the NPCs, but baby steps.
Well, baby steps.
It'll come. So yes, anyway, sir. Thank you so much for being today. I mean, I'm really seriously thrilled that the campaign is going so well. And I assume when Chris sent me the link, I looked at the campaign just, okay, yeah, well, what are the pledge levels? 100, that's the one. And I just went for it because it sounds absolutely unbelievable. So
likewise for me. Facebook, I because of just me and because Google likes monitoring everything I do, my Facebook wall is populated almost 100% by tabletop games, whether it be board games or 5e. And yep. Unfortunately, there's more than a few popped up and like, been there, done that, seen that. And a lot of them is like, and unfortunately mine have been recently, we're bringing sci-fi to 5e. And I go, I did that 10 years ago, but thanks for showing up. It's interesting that so many, how many 5e sci-fi campaigns are posting, and they always hit my wall, and I was like, you know, I did this already. But then yours came down, and I clicked on it, and I was like, oh, something different, something unique, something that I think it has value in its own creativity, and also has value outside in the metaverse. It's importance outside of this in our modern day world, and how I immediately got drawn to it, and that's why I wanted to reach out for that.
Thank you so much. Yeah, my mentor Jeff Thorne always tells me, make new things, and I'm working very hard to follow that.
My idol is, unfortunately, as a person I have not met, my idol is Mike Pondsmith, the guy who created Cyberpunk 2020. And I lived within Mike Pondsmith's world, whether it be Cyberpunk or Mechtin, back in the late 80s and 90s. And so he was always somebody. If I ever get a chance to talk to Mike Pondsmith, I was like, you're the guy who got me where I am today, because that's who I followed. And it's ironic that I don't write for that system, but it's what I did write for the longest time. But, I definitely know what it's like to have a mentor out there, but sometimes they don't know who you are.
Indeed.
Right, my friend, thank you so much once again.
Thank you.
Many congratulations on the success. And hopefully it will be great to have you back sometime when, you know, whatever next plans come out of your head. It would be amazing.
I'd be happy to come back. Thank you so much. This was so much fun.
Awesome. Yeah. Likewise.